So Ajahn Brahm was gracious enough to let me loose on the general public once again. So for this evening's entertainment, I've got something you might be interested in, which is of relevance to every single one of us in this room, I hope. So for this evening's talk, I thought I would speak on the development of the simple life. And every single, it's completely obvious to you people who are working. Many of you are working full time, part time, and you have families and children and other responsibilities to take care of. And so, how do we actually approach this? To actually simplify our lifestyle and essentially to decrease the amount of stuff and baggage that we have to deal with. And especially with the access to internet and smartphone technology, it's completely obvious to everyone just how busy and how demanding your lives can get, just within the area of communication and technology. But there's a number of principles that we can actually explore. Different areas of one's life, an internal circle, a small circle, and then radiating out into the community and even across the globe. And because every single one of us, except the monastics, definitely have a much quieter time, with their daily experience, and that's really the way it should be. At the monastery, we have our work routine that we have in the morning, but from after the meal onwards, the monastery is very, very quiet, and there's lots of time to practice, unlike people in general society. And so, if you look at your immediate situation, if you look at things very, very close to oneself, one's immediate surroundings, where we live, and this is a thought which just came up right now in relation with this. But when you look at the surroundings within your abode where you live, your home, your apartment, and you might be in shared accommodation, and just look around you and look at the amount of physical, requisites, material things that you have. It could be books, could be, God knows, it could be laptops, personal belongings, sporting equipment, anything you can possibly think of. How much stuff, do you have in the space that you live and that you spend many hours a day frequenting, because the average person in society, usually their home, they've got to be their home at least 8 hours in a 24-hour cycle, because you've got to sleep, you've got to cook and clean and this type of thing. So you're constantly in contact with these material things which are filling the space in your immediate environment, and these things, physical objects, are impinging upon your personal space, your personal freedom, your time, personal time and energy. And why is this the case? So, it's a common sense principle, but not everyone pays attention to this. Meditators who have a much greater degree of intuitive awareness see this more clearly. Meditators have a much greater peripheral awareness of other people and their environment. So we're sitting at home, possibly in our lounge room or in our sleeping space, and we could be you could be surrounded by an incredible amount of stuff or a very small amount of some material objects. And I went out on a dharma say within the last week, and with the blessing format, there was a lady I did. There was a secondary blessing in a house, so like an apartment nearby, and that particular lady's, it was quite unusual. That lady's place was absolutely full of stuff. It's like moving a complete house, say like the contents of a 3-bedroom house, into a more say like a smaller 2-bedroom apartment, and it's just a reflection, not a criticism on the person concerned. You know, in case she finds out and comes looking for me at some point in the future, which might be quite possible. But this particular person, and it could be completely justified. They could have actually moved house weeks before I walked in their front door, but they had absolutely hundreds of magazines, you know, hundreds of stuff that, you know, things that you pick up from the news agency, and, you know, ribbons and bits of paper and scissors and this and that. But, you know, you could have a person there who's into arts and crafts, and you can justify these things. And you know, people have their hobbies and interests, and it could be, you know, completely logical in every way. But all of us are well aware that the more personal stuff that we have within our living space, the more time we have to actually spend on, dusting, cleaning, maintaining these things. And I remember when I went home to see a friend of mine, and when his kids were quite little, his two daughters, maybe they were about, three and five, and you know their toys and the stuff that they play with was just absolutely everywhere. You couldn't move through the lounge room without basically, you know, tripping up on this stuff. You wouldn't want your granny walking through that area in case, you know, she took a fall and basically, you know, like maybe broke an arm or a leg, which is quite possible for an elderly person. So, you know, naturally that's the natural behavior of children, and parents do have to give their kids some slack. You know, they're very well aware of their little people behavior. So, but you know, it's pretty obvious. You know, when your living space is full of stuff, you know, you've got to pay more attention, more time and energy to look after it and to sort of navigate your way around it. You know, people whose residences are full of stuff, you actually, instead of like walking from one room to another, you may have to climb over things or circle round, you know, the stuff that one has. So as soon as you simplify, you reduce the material possessions right to a minimum, that actually it frees up not only the internal space but your personal time and energy. You know, these things don't demand your attention. And so as we move out and we move into a greater peripheral circle, into one's, circle of friends and associates. And all of you are well aware of the dynamics of Facebook and Google and God knows, you know, what else is available on the internet or with smartphone technology, with social communication, social media. And people can take up a lot of time, even like hours a day, and on social communication and blogging and all this kind of thing. But the thing is, people may have genuine interests in this area. You know, so, you know, people, some people are into, you know, very, very specific areas of study, which may be quite really quite important to them. And I'm not saying that that you people should be cutting into those pursuits and hobbies and interests which are of great personal value to you, because they may be quite necessary for your personal growth and development, and may be very meaningful to you. But you know, if you look at it on a broader level, especially for people who are into spiritual practice, how many websites do you need to engage in and post your opinions? I mean, how many Facebook friends do you need? And naturally, I mean, I have absolutely no idea whatsoever how Facebook works and functions. But you know, you think to yourself when you look at friends and associates, there will definitely be people who are very valuable and important to you, and these are the people that you're more than willing to spend time with and communicate and chit chat with. And from my perspective, and especially with the monastics, that one really doesn't have any choice. One has to minimize the contact with one's family and one's old friends to at least a small degree. And because essentially it's endless. You know, it's good to catch up with people at say like intervals of time. Like I would catch up with my brother maybe every 2 or 3 months, and I have to contact my parents every 2 weeks. It's something that that my father insists on quite firmly. So you know, just to keep my parents happy, it's something I have to do. So, but with old friends and associates, every couple of months or so, and you think within yourself, what to maintain a good quality relationship with people within your circle. How many times, say through the week or even on a 4 weekly cycle, do you need to actually contact them and engage them and chit chat with them and whatnot, So this is more streamlined approach. And it's very, very easy for me to say these kind of things, but it's a personal thing with every single person in this room. But how much time do you really need to spend with friends and associates? And one of the guidelines is just look at the quality of time principle. And if the time that you actually spend talking with family members and friends and associates, in person or on the internet, if you actually, a very easy way to assess this one is, how is the quality time factor? If you're chit chatting with family and friends and you really don't enjoy it, you really are not interested, and you get nothing from it, maybe of no benefit to you substantially whatsoever on any level, then you're quite within your rights to limit the amount of time you spend with that person. You don't have to cut them off. I mean, all the old friends that I have from lay life, I'm still connected with these people, but you can feel it within yourself intuitively when it's time to catch up and to make sure that they're doing okay and things are quite reasonable within the family and their work and their personal lives and their hobbies and interests. It's something you can intuitively feel when it's time to catch up with different people. But you may feel that you may want to streamline your Facebook friends and associates and the people that you hang out with at work, because some people may not be conducive for you and may actually be a hindrance, because you become, through the process of conditioning, that you become like the people that you associate with. So because I bounce into the prison system, roughly every 2 weeks usually every 2 weeks on a regular basis, it's completely obvious to me that if you become the people that you associate with, these people rub off on you. All of us mix with a different type and grade of individual, from from the dead average to very, very high-minded individuals. And it's just a common sense principle. If you mix with criminals and thieves and drug users, that those people... but when I talk about drug users, I'm not talking about recreational users. I'm talking about really, really hardcore users and addicts, people with real dependency issues. If you're mixing and socializing with people in that category, and I'm not disparaging these people, because some of these people are genuine victims of circumstances. I see that very, very clearly with the guys that I mix with up at Carnet. Some of these people have grown up in very compromised circumstances. But if you associate with this category of people, they're going to rub off on you. They're going to affect your life, possibly in an unconducive manner. And they could do this in a way which actually creates problems for you, which complicates your lifestyle, which places demands on your time and attention, because some of these people are very very, very high maintenance, they're very manipulative, and you just got to be very quite careful. But I'm still, it's more along the lines of simplifying, streamlining, just reducing the pressure, the problems, the difficulties in your own lives, because life is difficult enough, especially when you're working full time. So you don't want to make life any more sort of give yourself any more hardship than you have say already. You don't want to increase what you've got on your plate currently. So you pick and choose your friends, and if you're mixing with wholesome people, not necessarily, they don't have to be perfect in any way, just decent people, you find that your life doesn't become overly complicated, overly troublesome, because you're mixing with the right type of people. And so this principle again of increasing. Increasing the simplicity of the mind, so to speak, in a sense of minimizing the proliferation and excessive thinking, worries and concerns. So people in general, if they don't necessarily have a a recreational focus, hobbies and interests which bring them a degree of satisfaction and fulfillment and help to balance the mind and essentially compensate for, potentially like the daily grind, when you're having to work, 5 to 6 days a week to pay your bills. It could be a standard 8 hours up to 12 to 16 hours a day for some people. Some people have to work, you know, two jobs because they've got, you know, really big mortgages. And they could possibly have a small tribe, you know, maybe of three, four, five people, five children, and their partner, and they've got, you know, really big overheads. So by having a, say, you know, say like a simplifying one's mind state, so, you know, through your day and maybe early evening, you know, things could be full on. You could have a lot of things that you have to address, that you have to be concerned about. But if you are able to simplify and to shut one's mind down and reduce the busyness and the, you know, just the amount of excessive thinking and emotional intensity that you actually have within your mind, it's of great fruit and benefit, so to speak, as an exaggeration, because, you know, even just getting 5 minutes break from 5 minutes rest from that debacle, that, you know, all that stuff which is constantly spinning in your mind, which may not be of any great value or use to you, because a lot of us, we disperse mental energy on things which are completely useless and of no value whatsoever. You're essentially splitting and diverting the mental energy that you have within your mind into essentially unconducive and worthless activities. And this is something which is completely obvious to the monks, because we're working with this stuff all the time. So, you know, like easily 95% of what I think of on a daily basis is absolutely completely useless and of no benefit whatsoever. But it can be beneficial in a sense that if you use it for investigation, you use it to sharpen your wisdom faculty, then, you know, you can take this chaff, you can take this this material, and you can sharpen your insight practice. So, you know, no matter how maybe repetitive and how maybe petty and how you may feel it's just very, you know, very, very basic stuff, you know, very, very simple stuff, which is not even worthy of your attention. You can still sharpen your wisdom faculty by investigating this material, because even if it's come up in your mind like 100 times, 1,000 times, one of the reasons why it keeps coming up for you on a regular basis, because you're attached to it, and the reason you're attached to it is because you don't fully understand your relationship with this material, and the proof of the pudding is that you can't let it go. If you really understand any phenomena in the mind, any mental phenomena in the mind, you can drop it within 5 to 10 seconds, and this is the test, the proof in the pudding. You know, sometimes people say to me, and even monks have said to me, I'm not attached to my daughter. But I said, of course you are. And they'll argue, no, I'm not attached to my daughter at all. But the thing is that, you know, they're ringing their daughter on a weekly basis, which proves that they still care and they still love and they're still emotionally concerned, you know, with their child, even though she's a grown-up and she's independent. You know, dad, no matter how, you know, this is all within a framework of delusion. This is all of us go through this kind of stuff. But it's a matter of, you know, coming to an understanding of states of mind. And this person was just arguing back and forth. But in the end, you know, you can't argue with something like that, because that, you know, this is the test. Whatever, and including myself, whatever I cling to, essentially, that the insight in with this particular principle hasn't gone deep enough for me to relinquish and let it go, you know, because all of us on the level of the mind, you know, this this principle of letting go is something which cuts the ice again and again and again. If we have things which are very close to our heart, we have problems, difficulties, we've got somebody on our case, somebody that we're obsessed with, if you can't release it, it's because the wisdom faculty is not sharp enough, the insight hasn't gone deep enough. So to simplify one's mind, one needs to investigate this stuff. And naturally, I just don't, I don't expect anyone to drop their children, their partner, their hobbies and interests and whatnot. This is the Buddhist path is a gradual training. It's like a slowly catchy monkey type of perspective, and each person moves at their own speed at a comfortable level, because you're looking at a lifetime's work with this business. And so developing this simplicity of mind, do I need to watch the television so much, which stimulates my busyness, or listen to the radio, or go surfing on the internet, which gives me extra things to think about and to discuss and maybe argue about within my own mind, or maybe extra material to discuss with my friends. But some of this stuff may be very useful and may be quite necessary. So I'm just talking in general principles, and each person will see very clearly over time exactly what is necessary and what isn't over time, over many months and years. And so, this slowly developing the, say like a minimum of say 5 minutes every day with the meditation practice, and 5 minutes is not to be sniffed at. It's really quite substantial if you do that, every single day, for 7 days a week continuously. You'll definitely see an effect of that, and even if you sat for 5 minutes before work, that mindfulness, you would actually see that mindfulness sustain itself right through the course of the day. And we had one of our former monks, Jasper, and he would only meditate for 20 minutes in the morning before he came to the monastery and cut down all our trees to a small degree. But bit of an overstatement. We were just thinning out the forest. That's a more correct perspective on it. And some of us, we're lamenting, just how many of the smaller trees and ferns and bushes and so to speak were being basically eradicated. But the thing is that on a practical level, we didn't have any choice. We had to thin the forest and to reduce the fire risk, because too much fuel on the ground, if the forest is too thick, fire comes through, just destroys everything. All the big trees get completely wiped out as well. So, but he would meditate for 20 minutes in the morning, and then he would come into the monastery and crank up the chainsaws, and he would be working with the chainsaws for a minimum, say, 8 hours a day. And he was, even with the chainsaw like screaming for hours on end, naturally he was wearing earmuffs, that he could feel that mindfulness sustain itself right through the course of the day under these sort of quite extreme conditions. And there's the proof in the pudding that mindfulness has the strength and energy to sustain itself for 8 hours in that kind of work scenario. So anyone who works in an office or on a factory floor or even in an engineering firm should be able to see that over time. And so within, so you know, yeah, so a daily meditation routine
to keep the mind,
say, simple, you know, more simple and more energetic and more relaxed, you know, because you know, even for myself, like when I come in here, which is very rare, and I give a talk and provoke the masses, that you know, I meditate for a couple of hours in the morning, but I don't meditate in the afternoon because I've got to be on the ball and I've got to be able to remember everything I need to say when I'm up here behind this microphone, because I find that I can get peaceful quite, you know, quite quickly, especially when when the conditions are good, and I find that it shuts my mind down very, very quickly, where it may be very, very difficult to remember everything you need to know and articulate. So each person will see with their practice, you know, they work within a comfortable range. Some people can do these like 1 minute meditations at any time of the day and function quite effectively. You can be a business manager, CEO, you know, this and that, and you can do these little 60 minute meditations any time of the day or night, flawlessly, without compromising your intelligence and your memory power. So, you know, and it's a very, very useful little skill to have. So whenever you feel stressed or things that, you know, are just getting, you know, on your case and you just need time out, you know, for 60 seconds, just sit down in a quiet corner, just go into a quiet room and just watch your breathing just for one minute. And when I was in the hospital system, the charge sister who'd been a registered nurse for absolute minimum 40 years plus 45 years, what she would encourage with the junior staff, because we're working on a really busy male surgical urology ward, is when the nurses got stressed out, she would ask them to go into the lunchroom or into a quiet space and then just breathe slowly and deeply for 60 seconds. And it's just amazing how refreshing and how tranquilizing that can be, because when you breathe deeply and you flood your body and your mind with oxygen, it naturally relaxes and calms the mind. And it's a very quick application that you can use when things get really, really, say, heavy or stressful. And so, you know, each person will see exactly, you know, how with their routine and how much they can do and what time of the day is actually appropriate for them. So, what else do I have for you? So if we look on the area of say greater technology, you know, everyone's well aware of smartphones and the power that they actually have over people and the amount of time that people spend on them. And a lay practitioner who's a meditator came to the monastery the other day, and she was saying that she just can't believe that these people are just just completely obsessed with their phones, and they're even like they're checking their phones, you know, when they're upstairs, you know, just before the meal. And I had a gentleman who used to sit, I mean, almost in front of me or slightly to the side, and these days I always usually give a little talk just before the meal, you know, because, you know, the lay disciples, you know, go to a lot of trouble to support the community, and, you know, you need to, you know, just give them, you know, at least something, you know, some Dharma reflection, something which might be useful for them in their everyday life. And this gentleman, like, would be there, you know, like, you know, so, you know, he'd be surfing on the web or he'd be checking his email, and I found this like so traumatizing. I couldn't even look at this guy while I was talking, because it would just really blow me away. And so, you know, as soon as this guy got onto his phone, I mean, I would just close my eyes and completely ignore him, or focus on someone, you know, down the back of the room who was actually paying attention. But it's much easier. And when you close your eyes, it's much easier to articulate and focus. Some people, you know, it's understandable to a degree, but, you know, some people just get taken over by these little devices, and in a way, it's like almost like obsessional behavior. I mean, what, you know, even if I had a smartphone, I mean, why would I waste my time checking my Gmail every hour of the day, or surfing Google for some nonsense which is going to be completely of no value to my personal life whatsoever. But it all depends on your perspective, because, you know, what might be a complete waste of time from my perspective may be of great fruit and benefit to some of you people in the audience here. So each man or woman to their own, as they say. So, a lot of you are very, very well aware of these kind of dynamics. And, you know, you can slim and trim the amount of time that you spend on your electronic devices. And this similar principle, you know, if you use the quality of time principle, quality time, that will give you a very, very clear indication of what you are doing, regardless of time and circumstances. You know, is that of value? Is that fruitful, or is that of no value whatsoever? You know, look at the quality of the engagement, whether it's your smartphone, your computer, your friends, your personal interests, hobbies, activities, any kind of community engagement. And things like charity work, I would never ever I can't think of the right words. I would never ever undermine or criticize in any way anyone who engages in any kind of charity work, charity support, you know, because they're projecting their goodness out into the general community. And I've got a good friend whose flatmate spends at least like a full week every month doing charity work for disabled people, for workshops, for pensioners, for hospital visits, and he's got this like a small smorgasbord of charity organisations that he supports, and even things like, you know, like so, like, you could have a retired pensioner a couple of doors down who's got arthritis and can't do, you know, the little handyman jobs and can't paint her front door and this and that, and he was a professional painter by trade and is quite skillful with his hand eye coordination. So, you know, he would just go down there and help them out and have morning tea with them and slap on a couple of coats of paint and this and that, and do a few little odd jobs, and, you know, if you've got like a tradesman in, they'd probably charge you a couple of $100. So, but he got that sense of real joy and satisfaction, a sense of fulfillment helping some poor pensioner who kind of, you know, couldn't afford to employ someone and is not capable themselves. So, you know, things like that, you know, have great value, can have great personal value to oneself and to other people in a community level. You know, so you can look at quality of time in that perspective. And what else do we have? So I think that's probably about it. Nothing incredible comes to mind. So, if any of you people have some controversial, hard-hitting questions, please don't be shy. So, does anyone have anything to say? Any views, opinions, any challenging statements? No? Oh, you're just making it too easy. Yeah, I don't know if there's anything coming through on the iPad. We'll soon find out. I'll just leave, just give my friend a minute or two. I'm not sure what's happening in the back room there. Okay, John from the USA, how does one deal with alienation or disapproval of moving from chaotic lifestyle to a simple one? How does one deal with alienation or disapproval of moving from chaotic lifestyle to a simple one? Oh, I'm just baffled. How does one deal with alienation or disapproval of moving from chaotic lifestyle to a simple one? It's alienation or disapproval. All right, the only examples I can think of, which come to mind, is, say for example, I could be a, I don't know, maybe I'm a wealthy yuppie person. This is the only thing I can think of, who is a spiritual person. But they're mixing with, I don't know, they could be mixing with the wealthy elite, the wealthy and powerful. And so they're mixing with, say, upper class, high class people who are upwardly mobile and have nice homes and flash cars and move within their own social circles and their own, flamboyant tea parties and morning teas and all this kind of stuff. So you could have a person who's a high flyer, making, you know, incredible money, you know, mixing with these very, mixing with the jet set, you know, the beautiful people, the wealthy elite, all this kind of thing, and with, you know, moving within the high strata of society. And then that person, say, for example, wants to simplify their lifestyle. They want to practice the spiritual life and simplify their day-to-day existence. When they've got these kind of social pressures on them, they're surrounded. You know, they're moving in these kind of social circles, and they want to simplify their lifestyle. Well, a possibility is that they, you know, if you're incredibly fortunate to have bags of money, that you could move from Cottesloe or Peppermint Grove and get yourself a nice little property out the back of Armidale up in the hills there, or maybe somewhere else, which is a very charming location. And get yourself, build yourself a nice little, home, very compact, you know, natural, timbers and, maybe tile floors and, you know, lovely, say natural resources and products. And possibly maybe find a less high powered position of employment, and so, you know, change location, you know, get yourself a nice, simple, beautiful surrounding on the edge of the state pass, the state forest or national park area, where it's quiet, peaceful. You can gaze upon the trees, you can gaze upon the possums and the kangaroos, which would be there in abundance, which we have plenty of at the monastery, but we don't seem to have plenty of everything else for God knows what reason. Could be some environmental problems there. But so you change your location, so you've got a beautiful setting, peaceful, you're rising with the birds, You know, you can hear the wind in the trees. You can hear the little birds chirping outside your window. And so you've simplified your external environment. And then you start working on your meditation practice. You should have more time. You've got a more simple abode. You should easily be able to squeeze in 30 minutes, an hour every single day, like clockwork. And even things like, even with your dietary needs, instead of indulging in the flash cuisine that you did previously, you could start to live on could be even like raw foods or even cooked vegetables and more simple processed foodstuffs and recipes to help minimize the time that you spend, say, like cooking and partaking of the meals that you prepare. So, because, you know, everyone's well aware that when you cook really flash meals, you know, you can get a lot of really nice processed foods, but which can save you a lot of time. But you know, if you keep your diet more simplistic, you know, vegetables, fruits, nuts, beans, you know, lentils and whatnot, you don't have to spend so much time cooking this stuff and cleaning all these extra dishes, which comes with, you know, with preparing really, really flash meals. And there's lots of little tricks, little ways to minimize the time that you engage in all these things which absorb your time and energy. I remember there was a registered nurse, a male nurse that I knew from Santi Monastery on the East Coast, and this guy was working at the local hospital in Bowral, I think it was. I'm pretty sure it was Bowral. And he was incredibly lucky. He managed to get himself a small cottage right in the middle of the state forest on a small mountain track going into the, you know, where they've got the power lines, where they've got these bush tracks going into the areas where the power lines actually cross through the state forest area. And his little shack wasn't under the power lines. It was off maybe about 500 meters, and so he couldn't even hear the electrical current moving through the grid there. And you know, really, really peaceful, and, you know, surrounded by wild animals, and it was just absolutely perfect. And he was after his divorce proceedings, you know, his ex, you know, gracefully, you know, took about, I don't know, probably at least 60-70% of everything he had, because, you know, of the two children. But in the end, he couldn't afford to buy a house in his immediate locality, so he was thinking of moving to Tasmania in similar conditions, because he was a meditator, regular meditator. He was a Buddhist spiritual person, and he was going to transplant himself to a similar location in Tasmania with those kind of supporting conditions. So, beautiful lifestyle, you know, with all the supporting dynamics, and that is the way I would recommend anyone to go if you're like dead serious. And I mean, I've got that, you know, that's the kind of lifestyle I live. You know, I've got a little kuti in the forest, surrounded by trees, got kangaroos bouncing you know, out my front window every morning, every evening, kangaroos bouncing past my front door, my back window. I can hear the little birds chirping in the bushes nearby, and little geckos running around on my walking path. And they're so fearless. I mean, they must understand, because even if I crouch down and put, and, you know, if I put my finger in front of a gecko, he sniffs my finger, and I can actually put my finger right in front of him, and you'll just like run up my finger and then run over and go on his merry way. And, you know, these little creatures are just fearless. They know the monks won't harm them. So, Elliot from the USA, what advice would you give to an older adolescent with a desire to ordain? What advice would you give to an older adolescent with a desire to ordain? How old is this adolescent? All right. for people who want to ordain, definitely, yeah, definitely give it a whirl, because you might even like it. So, you know, usually you find that one thing I saw, to give you an example, we had one young man who was, he was 17, 18, at least 17, and the boy was brilliant, really brilliant. He was going to do nuclear medicine, and he was going to do nuclear medicine, and he was going to work, because he was so smart. He had a job lined up with NASA in the United States as soon as he graduated. You know, this boy was like in the top 1% of the country, but he was interested in becoming a monk, and one of the senior monks, Ajahn Yanadamo, could see that he was still quite boyish. You know, he wasn't. He still had a young man's head on his shoulders, and he advised him basically to do his whatever it was, his 4 to 5 years. It's a PhD, so it's got to be absolute. I'm only guessing, absolute minimum 5-6 years full time. Correct me if I'm wrong. And he would have just breezed through that. And so after 6 years, you know, he encouraged him to do at absolute minimum several years, 2 to 3 years, and to, you know, to go out and to socialize and to have girlfriends and go to parties and travel, yeah, and do things. And because no matter how high or altruistic or pure your intentions are, that with some people, if you don't get some worldly experience, you won't necessarily be well grounded when you eventually ordain, because some people, if you don't get the travel and the girlfriends and the education and the hobbies and interests out of your system, you may actually find it difficult to settle down when you come to the monastery. And most of our monks, you know, they've been through the traps. Trying to make a bad impression when I say this, but you know, many of our monks have been through the mill, you know, with their relationships, with the drugs, with the travelling, you know, this and that. They've done it all, and you know, there's nothing left. And so it's time to knuckle down and really get on with the practice, and to practice full time. So, you know, essentially, you know, you really you've got to look honestly within yourself. You know, are you prepared to commit for the next 5, 10, 20, 30 years? And there's no guarantees. People can skip out 5 years after 30 years. And these are people with absolutely bags and bags of experience. And even then, with 30 years or more, they can still walk away. So no one should ever think that you're going to be doing this till the day you die. But within your own mind, you need to understand your strengths, your weaknesses, and you need to to essentially keep yourself going, you know, just keep the ball rolling, so to speak, on a day-to-day basis. But yeah, so just make sure, you know, the person is grounded, they're together. To come into robes too young is not so great. We had one of the monks at the monastery who came in quite young, at age 21, and was really into meditation, like big time, minimum 6 to 8 hours a day, and was the most restrained, solitary, focused person you could meet. And then something happened. So he went through about like 7 years of quite solid practice, and then he started to lose his mindfulness and his focus, and he eventually disrobed. And but you know, it's not a bad thing, because the thing is, you get 7 years of very, very solid training. And you don't lose that, you know, even 5-10 years later, you've still got a big chunk of that, that, you know, that Dhamma, that, that, personal experience. So, were there any more questions from the floor before we wrap it up? Okay. So, gentleman in the back.
This was just concerning your comment on attachment and how you said that you need to have that clarity of mind to have that attachment.
Clarity of mind.
Clarity of mind, sorry, to understand the attachment. So you can let it go. I had a tightness in my chest for a long time, and just releasing that tightness, I realized there was an emotional attachment behind it. But I also kind of sense that a lot of my actions that I do, a lot of my thoughts, I sometimes come from my past attachments, but I don't know how to become aware of them. So I was wondering what the best method would be.
What I'd recommend, I would work with it, regardless of the underlying causes and circumstances. I've got this physical pain. See, like physical pain in the center of my chest, which could be like stress related. So how do I actually work with this? So what I would do is something I always recommend is this focusing technique, which was formulated by this Buddhist psychotherapist from the US. Her name is Eugene D. Jellin, and the book is called Focusing. And what she does, in a nutshell, she's got this 6-step process where the meditators will understand, will cotton onto this very, very quickly. 6-step process, you spend 1 minute focusing on that part of the body which is difficult, which is painful, which is tight, physically affected. Just focus on that experience. And it can even be in the shoulders, it can be in the neck. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the center of the body, but many people feel their emotional stuff in the center of the body, the torso. So you've just gently focused for 1 minute with your samadhi, and after 1 minute, then you just do a small investigation. How does this feel? How do I describe this feeling? It could be painful, tight, tense, and then I stop there. Then I focus again for 1 minute, just very gently, on the physical feeling. And then I investigate again, a bit more deeply. How is this feeling affecting my body and affecting my mind? And then you investigate it a little bit the second time around, a little bit more deeply. And it could be something like it's making my body feel uncomfortable. I can't sit, I can't relax, I can't sleep, and I may not even be able to breathe properly. I've got this pain in my chest, I can't even breathe properly, and through tightness, muscular tightness. So and you just investigate a little bit more deeply, and then you focus again, and then for 1 minute, and then you reflect a third time. And you just keep going deeper and deeper and deeper into the experience, investigating it more deeply, increasing your awareness and understanding. Because I'm going right to the heart of the matter. I'm not trying to work it out on a surface level intellectually. I can just go round and round in circles like this for 5 or 10 years. I go directly to the body where the problem is. The body's intuitive. It's a feely experience. And so you keep to keep this very, very simplistic, you just keep moving back and forth between this gentle focusing and investigation, and you do it to the point where there's a experience of release. You can actually feel it. There's an experience of physical release in the body, and when you reach that point, then you know for a fact that you've made a small breakthrough, and you've let that thing go to a significant degree. And that's the approach. It's a paperback book. It's probably about, you can get it on the internet. It's at least $14, $15. But it's very, very, and especially meditators will cotton on with this very, very quickly. They'll understand this particular approach very, very quickly. And it's very user friendly for anyone, because it's so easy to work with.
Thank you. I was just also wondering, do most of your attachments manifest physically, or are they like attachments that do not manifest physically, or like in your experience?
They can manifest on both levels. So it all depends on what the attachment is, and whether it's a personal, whether it's a material object, it could be a speedboat or some kind of nice car, or it could be anything. It could be the latest smartphone. And it all depends in whatever level how meaningful it is to you. People are so different that some people may only get physically affected, some people may get both physically, quite pronounced physical and emotional effect. Usually, but it's coming from your mind. Your mind is the key player. So you've got this particular thing, could be a person, could be a physical object, could be stress. It affects your mind. It brings about an emotional response. And then if I speak in the current tense, if I can't deal with this thing or it's creating problems for me, I won't only feel it emotionally. That energy may go out into my physical body. So the energy, if it starts to build up, if I've got emotional energy starting to build up, it may reach a point where it becomes that physical, that emotional stress starts to play out in my physical body. It can do things like it can even accelerate arthritis in my joints and stuff like that. All sorts of things are possible. And that energy, because if I talk in the first person, because I can't deal with this thing, I can't work it out and resolve it. It's moving through me, and it's finding it's like the energy is moving out from my mind out into my physical body. It's trying to find an outlet, but it can only go so far. So it's locked inside my physical body. It could be working through. It could be working through my stomach, this and that. But it stops there. I can't release it. It's trapped. It's trapped inside my physical frame, and you feel the symptoms. So until I resolve this thing, it won't essentially go away.
Thank you.
Is there anything else before we finish up? Okay, no more questions. So we'll just pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha and we'll finish up.